Good morning or afternoon, everybody. Welcome back to the Midwestern Archaeology Podcast. Today, I am joined by David Ian Howe, an archaeologist, anthropologist, and storyteller whose work spans from academic labs to field digs to the director's chair. David's career includes years of hands-on archaeology with organizations like New South Associates and the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers Veterans Curation Program, where he helped preserve and interpret prehistoric and historic artifacts. He's also the founder of How and Why Productions, where he brings complex historical and anthropological topics to life through videos, podcasts, and films. He hosts podcasts Ethnosinology and The David Ian Howe Show. And today we are going to be diving into his research on dogs in Native American culture and the deeper meanings behind our oldest animal companions. David, thank you so much for being here today.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to chat.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So just to get started out, again, thank you so much. I've been a fan, followed you for a while, so I really enjoy the stuff that you put out online. I'm really interested in what got you into archaeology initially, and if you were always interested in the field, and then after you kind of gave some background, what got you specifically into the study of dogs and anthropology and stuff like that?
Yeah. This answer always changes. So if you hear me on another podcast, it's probably a different one, but it's it's just so many things. Always loved history. I loved Steve Irwin, History Channel, Bill Nye, that whole thing as a kid in the 90s. Mm. And just loved that. And then went to school. I loved History Channel, Rome, Greece. I went to school for history at first. And then I took an Anthropology 101 class at the University of Tennessee, Chattanooga. And was like, oh, wow, this is what I want. This is like primatology. This is archaeology. This is evolution. This is everything. And she had suggested, my professor, I go to University of Tennessee, Knoxville, because it had a better anthro program. So I switched schools and ended up getting roped into paleo archaeology, like with the Topper site and Clovis, hunter-gatherer stuff, Ice Age, North America. And I guess to boil it down, what I really liked in history was the interaction between the Spanish and the Native Americans, like in Mesoamerica. Mm. And I found that fascinating, but I wasn't sure why. And then I learned, through archaeology, it's like a Stone Age culture in the Neolithic meeting, whatever you want to call it, like a gunpowder age culture or like an age of exploration culture, and how that clashes. And like at the heart of that is anthropology. And then something that unites both the old and the new world is the dog. When the Spanish got here, they were like, oh, they have dogs. I guess they're not, animals. it's a rough way to put it, but it's kind of what they said in their journals. And for the most part, I loved dogs. And how would I put this into it? There was a History Channel documentary called Mankind, the Story of All of Us. And it was narrated by Josh Brolin. Came out when I was in college, 2011. And it's human history from the dawn of man to now. And the first episode, it starts out with Africa hunting. And then the next scene is Ice Age Europe with wolves. And I was like, whoa, go back. I want more on that.
Yeah, wait, there's a lot we're missing there. Yeah.
Yeah. And it just kind of tied right into, I'm studying hunter-gatherers. I'm studying stone tools. How do these people live? Oh, I understand. And I guess I'll try to keep this brief here, but how do I say it? It boils into ontology, which we'll get into, but
yeah,
how these people think, and you have to get into that mindset to get into how dogs came to be, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And that actually kind of leads into my other question about your background. So you mentioned that the History Channel and that there were a few documentaries that really got you into this subject, or at least initially piqued your interest. I wonder if that also has to do with your later forays into science communication and your work in documentaries and other kinds of educational video content that you came into. And I'm just curious how that came to be. Most archaeologists don't, because I work at a nonprofit where I work with a ton of archaeologists. Not all of them have that same proclivity for content creation. I'm just curious what that was like for you. Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's imperative now that we all get better.
Yeah. Absolutely.
But obviously some of it comes with inherent ability to do it. Some people just, I've seen like are just terrified to speak publicly, and I completely get it. They're probably way better at excavating than me. Yeah. or probably better at math or, you know, remembering to do their taxes. But let me think here. Yeah, man, I loved Bill Nye. I loved Steve Irwin. And just the fact that, and then, you know, Neil deGrasse Tyson by extent when I was in college, he kind of got big. Just the fact that you could make a job doing that, and pre-internet and pre-COVID for sure, like the idea of being a science communicator for a living was a very, it was almost like being an actor, you know, like you had to be, have an agent, you had to get a show, like how would you become Steve Irwin? So the most logical step for me was to do, cut that back. The most logical step for me then was to just go to school for archaeology or history first, and then, you know, work into that. But it was always in the back of my mind. And another thing too, not that I'm like, I think classically trained is the wrong word, because I never went to like a fancy, I was a public school kid. We were poor as a kid. But my parents like forced me to do music. Like I played cello, I played piano, and at like every wedding or bar mitzvah or, you know, christening, I had to like, my parents were like, play the cello in front of people, and like forced me to perform. And yeah, I just loved it. And then Jackass came out when I was in middle school, high school. So we would always run outside with the camera, record each other doing stuff.
Oh, okay, nice.
And that just kind of naturally, I think most millennials evolved right into social media and, you know, camera filming things. And the internet's kind of just shifted towards video content. But lastly, I'll say too, when I worked at my curation job, and I wasn't in school anymore, I'd come home, and anybody that's been in school knows this, like it's hammered into you. You have to be working on something. You need to be studying. You need to be writing. And I'd come home from a 9 to 5 and not have any work to do after work. And I had to like make that happen or else I was uncomfortable. So I like would start writing posts about dogs, and like I wasn't in school anymore. My other friends were still getting their PhDs. So I was like, I need to do something. So it turned into writing posts on Instagram, which then evolved into, well, now I have money from working. I can get a camera. And then I had this whole YouTube plan. And then it's kind of snowballed into where I am now.
That's awesome. I mean, honestly, that's really cool. So it kind of sounds like it started out as a hobby, and then it kind of evolved into like a side hustle. And now it's, now you're the dog archaeologist guy online, at least from my perspective anyway. I know that you have a really big social media following and such like that, so yeah, that's pretty cool.
Thanks, man. Yeah, I think it just, I just like talking about stuff I find interesting, and now you can profit off that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
So before we pivot into more of the content, I just remembered as you were talking about where you went to school, I was looking you up a little bit more. I was trying to find some more like details about where you went to school and stuff. And I saw you went to UTK, which is where I graduated as well. So it's cool to
see
another volunteer.
Oh yeah, man. I'm sure you had to hike up the hill every morning.
Oh yeah. Yep.
Yeah.
I'm so glad I don't need to do that anymore. Because that's like one of the hilliest campuses I've ever been on. But
dude, it was like the hill in the back of Lord of the Rings where they're trying to get up to the, you know, Mordor.
Yeah, I know.
And like, I would just skip class sometimes rather than go up that.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. Well, now they've got the electric scooters. You see people like zooming on. I mean, it's been a few years since I graduated, but they're making it more, the hill is less daunting than it was. But it's cool to see a fellow volunteer out here in the wilds.
Yeah, man. Good to see you.
So, okay. With that being said, let's just get into it. I read some of your papers, and something that kept getting brought up was your use of ontology to inform your study of the human-dog relationships. Uh-huh. And just a little refresher for listeners, ontology is just the study of how people understand the nature of being. So how they see and think about what exists in the world, and how things like people, animals, or spirits relate to each other.
Right.
So, which you have incorporated into studying like human dog history. And you also refer to something called the ontological turn. I was just curious what you mean by the ontological turn and how it can impact the way we understand animal human relationships.
Yeah. In my cultural anthropology like course in grad school, like my seminar class, my professor like forced me to read this book called How Forests Think and it's called The Ontological Turn, I think, or Towards an Ontological Turn, something like that. It's by Eduardo Cohn. And yeah, she like forced me to read it because there was an interesting chapter about dogs or a section on it. But it ended up changing my ontology, I guess, because you learn about Malinowski and you learn about, you know, Margaret Mead going to like the Pacific and all these places learning from different tribes and the newer in Africa, which I think was Mouse. And you're learning about all this stuff, but the book kind of points out you really can't be an effective cultural anthropologist at all. Like you can try your best, but you cannot be an effective cultural anthropologist unless you can understand their ontology. So an example of this would be like, it's just a harsh one, but I mean, the Spanish and the Portuguese, and I guess the French by extent too, like violently imposed Catholicism around the world in the 1500s in order to make good trading partners, obviously, but, and to teach their language and stuff, but to instill ontology and to make compliance. So like you will be subjugated, you know, because this book says so, and here's how we think about the world and here's your place in it. But also like, it does help understand whether you want to look at it from that angle or not, just on a beneficial, even if you were a benevolent person at the time, to get to understand someone who's from a completely different world. If you both unite under the ontology of Catholicism, like the heaven and the earth, and then like there's heaven and hell, there's God, there's
the king, we need to submit to the king and stuff like that. Yeah,
exactly. Once you're all on that same page, you can understand the world better and, you know, communicate better. And that's why the Portuguese went and made everyone in Japan, tried to make them Catholic too, so they can, you know, impose their ontology, make better trading partners, because they couldn't really conquer Japan. But in The Ontological Turn, it's like, if you want to be an anthropologist, not that you have to go convert them to your way of viewing the world, but it's the opposite. You have to like honestly submit to their view of the world. And if you grew up in this Judeo-Christian, or at least like agnostic Judeo-Christian point of view of the world that we have, you're never going to understand, like, you know, do trees whisper? Like, you know, like, does the moon have a soul kind of thing? You won't ever get that unless you're fully immersed in it. And a lot of that comes from kind of like the superior wharf hypothesis, learning your language influences your culture. And like, there's just so many hard blocks between learning these things. But The Ontological Turn is essentially like shifting towards, you know, understanding the way they view the world, not just their cultural systems. And I've kind of incorporated that into like my political like ideologies, my like life philosophies, not to be like hippy dippy, but it's just like, my professor put it this way. Anthropology should be, if you have Somali neighbors move next door, do you open up the blinds and be like, what the hell are they doing? Or do you open up the blinds and be like, I should have them over for dinner. And like, if everybody has that second version of it, like the world would just be easier.
Absolutely. And, and I think especially because dogs are not universally found in human societies, but they are like almost every now in the modern day, you'll find dogs probably in every country. And so everyone has an understanding, their own maybe local understanding of human dog relationships that could be very different from the one that we have in America. And especially the relationship that Native Americans pre-contact or during those contact years, like those couple hundred years of contact, that relationship was very different to the Europeans. And it's also very different for us because of like the dog culture that we have today of, I mean, it really does really kind of depends on the person, but it's just vastly different. So it makes sense why ontology is really important from trying to understand cultural relativism and kind of understanding the culture on its own terms. And I think that's what's so interesting is because it really is just like a different emotional and mental cosmological universe that dogs were in these Native American contexts. And if you have some like examples, I know you talked a little bit about the Iroquois in one of your papers. Do you have any examples of where dogs fit into that ontology, Native American ontology?
The answer I would give is in that paper in the book, Eduardo Cohn talks about how they would like, it wasn't ayahuasca, but it's some hallucinogen they'd give to dogs and blow it up their snout. And like in that state, they could, and I don't know if you've ever done hallucinogens or if you could say you can't, but not that I have, but you can.
No comment.
In that state, like obviously your consciousness is like scientifically, your consciousness is a little shifted. Like you come outside of yourself, you can step outside yourself for a second. So they believed that in them doing that and them doing that to the dog, they could, you know, talk to each other, commune better. And it's like, they would like whisper to the, and it speak what the guy called Motherese, which was like, you know, who's a good boy kind of thing.
Right, right. Yeah, like, yeah, yeah.
Make the dog trip balls and like do that to the dog, and it would instill better like learning to them or something like that. That's one example. But other examples, like an ontological thing, a major one.
Yeah.
Is just that in like Western society, we see ourselves as like, there's human and then there's animals. It's in our language, you know, beef versus cow, pork versus pig.
Yeah. Man is the dominator of nature, or it's like the steward, you know, Garden of Eden stuff. Yeah.
Right. Exactly. Whereas in other cultures and languages, their same word for the animal is the same as the meat. We're just a very big meat eating culture. Mm-hmm. But in our world, it's like human and animal. We're like different. In a lot of indigenous American mythology, especially, and this is kind of around the world, but specifically Native American mythologies, dogs, there's like human, there's animal, and then dog. It's its own category.
Really? Wow.
Yeah. And it's cool. Yeah, they're like seen as either, the word that gets used a lot is traitor. And that's probably just a mistranslation of some other indigenous
like
word.
Like traitor with a D or with a T?
With a T.
Oh, interesting.
Like they betrayed the other animals in a way, or they at least just defected from the other animals. And it's not, that's just the only word that I've seen used, but it doesn't necessarily mean a negative thing. It's just that dogs, you know, are more human than they are animal in a lot of these ontologies. And I think that is lost on us a lot. We see them as dogs or pets and just kind of animals in themselves. But in a lot of indigenous mythologies, it's like dogs are its own category. They have a spiritual place in the world that we don't, in the West, that don't physically like understand as well. And like they can speak with the other animals and us and kind of things like that. Or specifically in the Iroquois tradition, it's like they had the chance to be human, but like we're denied, so humans have to then take them in and care for them kind of thing. Yes. So, yeah.
Yeah, I remember reading that. And I think it's really interesting because, so I was going to get into this a little bit later and we'll probably touch on this later, but I work at a organization called the Archaeological Research Institute, which is like a nonprofit organization that focuses like on education, but also like doing digs. Like we do field school. Our field school is about to start like next week. And the site that we steward is the Gard Archaeological Preserve, which is the Fort Ancient, which were like the predecessors to the Shawnee, the Kickapoo. And
awesome.
It's unfortunate that we don't know, because they didn't have writing. We don't know the intricacies of the human dog relationship. But what we do know is that there were some burials that the dogs were buried alongside humans. Some of them were even buried with jewelry. And it's unfortunate because I do find this stuff really interesting, but there's only so much that you can really know. And that's true for a lot of the history of pre-contact history, is that we simply don't know. We can know how they may have left the dogs. Sometimes they just weren't buried at all. They were just kind of left there. Sometimes they were intentionally, there was a grave dug or something like that. It is still pretty interesting because they definitely commanded a lot of respect. I know that they also helped out a lot when it came to helping out with, so the thing about the Fort Ancient is that they were some of the first like fully sedentary agriculturalists in the Midwest. And so I know that like the dogs kind of helped them out in the fields, carrying sleds and stuff and baskets. But yeah, that's just an example of the regional relationship between them.
The Midwest and the Mississippian cultures, like dogs were huge.
Most definitely.
And kind of like you said, there's no writing to talk about them, but it was, you can find the bones for sure.
Absolutely. Yeah. So kind of moving away from the ontology and getting into the story of and history of human-dog relationships. This is now the deep history. On the steppe and tundra of Eastern Siberia, there's like the first evidence of dog domestication. Can you explain what that first contact that humans had with wolves was like, and how from that contact we eventually got dogs?
Yeah, there's really the closest thing to a wolf in Africa, I mean, there's wolves in Northern Africa. The jackal is technically a wolf, but in like Africa proper, hyenas kind of fill that big niche. African wild dogs kind of behave like coyotes, but like lions are your main predator kind of thing. And like panthers and cheetahs and not panthers. Yeah, I think panther. But when you get to Eurasia, there's like a very cold adapted, more socially cohesive and intelligent species as the wolf. That's very effective at taking out game that you've not seen before, that behave differently because it's not the savanna. It's like now the tundra. And you need those animals for your furs, obviously your skins, to keep warm. And you would have observed these animals behave and how they hunted, because obviously they wolves want to do it in the safest way possible to not get injured or gored by a bison or a rhino or a mammoth. I'm sure they weren't hunting mammoth directly, but at least the wolves weren't. But you probably would have watched that. And when wolves, who are a highly efficient, socially adaptable predator on a landscape, and very social, when another one comes in that's just as much apex, if not greater, there's going to be a clash. And wolves, being as adaptable as they are, probably would have just started scavenging from camps rather than, like, you know, just optimal foraging. It's easier to steal from humans than to hunt a bison. So that would have been happening. Like, definitely, we know that just based off of how dogs and coyotes and other canids behave now. But whether or not they were like cooperatively hunting at first, like throwing each other meat, or humans throwing the wolves meat, and then like how quickly they became like a pet wolf, you know, I don't know. But if you just thousands of generations of wolves getting more used to humans being around, kind of like coyotes are now, or raccoons to an extent, like a raccoon's a solid example. They move into urban human environments, have little fear of humans now. But if they were like big socially apex predators that close to our camps, you'd be more interacting with them, if that makes sense.
Right.
Kind of just that. You're just meeting on the tundra and it's like adapt or lose your population. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think what's interesting, and this is kind of just a random, just I'm just kind of interested in this. So obviously humans had been on Eurasia for some time. At that point, and there were even other hominids that were around as well before that, even earlier, Neanderthals, Denisovans, and stuff like that. I guess I'm just wondering out loud why humans, and why specifically this part of Eurasia that resulted in that kind of union of these two species, where before you had other, presumably, humans or hominids with similar hunting or subsistence strategies of hunter-gatherers, why that didn't result in an earlier kind of domestication. I mean, who's to say there hasn't been, we just haven't found evidence. I'm just curious if you know anything about that.
Yeah, I guess two answers. The common denominator there would be caribou. They both hunt a lot of caribou. So I'm not expert in caribou, but I imagine it's their range and how they behave might be more conducive to humans and wolves both interacting around the same area. But also modern humans are, you know, you have to have, I just made a big video on this, but like you have to have fine tailored garments to survive such a harsh condition. And you need bone needles and you need, you know, furs and stuff to do that. So Denisovans and Neanderthals couldn't get as far onto the steppe as humans could, because we could make better clothing. And I think just like, yeah, the further you push into wolf territory, the more you're going to interact, kind of thing.
Okay.
But that's just a hypothesis.
That's really cool. I mean, that's interesting. Yeah. It's just different because Eastern Siberia isn't the same as the Americas, whereas the Americas haven't had any hominids at all in its entire geologic history. Eastern Siberia, that does make sense, though, that humans, as they kind of pushing globally, would develop newer relationships with other animals that they hadn't really had. Because once that pairing happened, it seems like it was inevitable that it was eventually going to result. Like, it just seems so beneficial from the start.
Yeah.
And maybe that from my perspective, that's what it seems like, but maybe that wasn't the case.
Yeah. I mean, dogs, I guess house cats by extent too, have like won the evolutionary game. Like if there was a point system, dogs don't have to do anything. We just feed, like they've won. So it's more beneficial for dogs in a sense than it ever wolves than it is for humans.
I remember, I really wish that I could remember where I specifically read this. So before we kind of move into the changes that happened with wolves and going back into the Americas, I read something recently about ancient humans during this time, as you know, they have their animals, their dogs, or at least wolves that are kind of following their camps around and maybe picking the scraps and maybe some other animals as moving portable ecosystems, which is just such an interesting way of kind of visualizing how these human groups weren't just humans. They were bringing other animal species just along with them, sometimes intentionally, other times they were just kind of scavengers following, picking the scraps. I wish I could remember where I read. Yeah, it's kind of a fun way to imagine things.
Yeah, no, for sure. Especially later on with like cats and rats and everything. Yeah.
So I learned recently, as in a few days ago when I was preparing for this interview, that wolves evolved barking when they became domesticated and turned into dogs. Can you help me understand why barking coincided with domestication and what its function is? Because from what I understand, wolves don't really bark in the wild, really. They howl because it's more long distance and barking is more in your face, kind of talking to you.
Couple things. I'd say one, the biggest is neoteny, which is the retention of juvenile traits. So like all domestic animals like lose their horns, they lose their like more robust traits and become cuter, and like keep that infancy into adulthood.
Wow.
So puppy dog eyes are a literal bred-in thing, evolved thing.
Wow.
Like goats and cows lose their horns and stuff for the most part. But as a pup, wolves bark and yelp just like that, but it goes away when they're an adult because they start to howl more. You're keeping that juvenile trait in wolves. It's really cool. And what's cooler is that selected for? Because, barking and they alert if there's a tiger outside or an enemy, hunter camp. Is that selected for? Or is it just something that is a result of breeding to keep something more infantile and cuter and more docile? Does that barking just, it's just mutually beneficial all around again? And I don't know any citations or science behind this, but I've heard anecdotally that cats don't need to meow at all. They just do it to get human attention.
I've heard that as well.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know if it was like a Snapple cap or like actual science, but it makes sense. And like wolves knowing that, like, because they're a bark is more of a talk than a howl is. So like humans then talking back to the wolf, they would have over time just kept doing it. And it's just one of those things that's just like, not that intelligent design is a thing, but like, wolves and humans interacting and evolving together is like coexisting together is just such an inevitability in modern mammalian history. Yeah.
It's really interesting because me and my roommate, who's also my coworker, we were talking a few weeks ago about basically this topic, about how intentional when it came to the first kind of domestication event of dogs, how intentional it was that humans were breeding in certain traits, and how much of it was simply just a consequence of, well, you're going to kill the dog that tries to kill your kids because it's going to attack you. So just by consequence of not wanting to be around a dangerous animal over a certain, like countless generations, eventually those animals that start hanging around are going to turn friendly and stuff like that. I'm just curious from your perspective as an archaeologist and anthropologist, how much of this seems like it was intentional? How much of it was just kind of a coincidence or accident of just these two species being next to each other for this long?
I think you're right on the ball, Lee. Like it's the I don't want to say the offing, but the like just culling or killing of the ones that were aggressive is probably the biggest factor. Because the ones that were too aggressive and fearful of humans would have, bailed anyway or not been too far around. Mm-hmm. And not lingered around, and the ones that were aggressive enough that attacked humans would have been killed immediately. Because also we know they were using wolves for their furs and their bones and stuff too, and ornamental. Every culture around the world at some point wears a wolf skull on their head for some reason. The Romans,
it's cool. Aztecs,
it's just cool. that would have been happening. So the wolves would have learned quickly, and I think. I mean, I can never say for sure without a time machine, but I would say that is the number one factor. It's just like creating more compliant and docile changing their ontology, I guess.
Yeah.
You're making more docile ones. Yeah.
Which I think the crux of what me and my friend were debating was just getting, sometimes people get confused, I think, when they learn about dog evolution, dog history. Well, not dog evolution, but dog history and dog adaptation and stuff, is they conflate Victorian, like late, early modern kind of dog breeding with that initial domestication, which from what we've been saying, that initial domestication they weren't doing that with the intention of creating dogs. They were doing it with the intention of just trying to survive and make choices that made sense to them. And that's very different than what you see later with the Victorians, just kind of picking and choosing different traits that they liked for different reasons and stuff.
Yeah. I tell people, just think dingo, and that, like, that's what dogs look like for 10,000 years. It's just a yellow standard coat wolf. Yeah.
So, okay, I have a question. I'm curious now. So if theoretically 10,000 years ago, if you were to take a dog from Eastern Siberia and a dog from like Louisiana, hypothetically, they would look similar. They would basically look as you just described.
Yes, superficially, because I mean, a Chihuahua and a Great Dane do look similar in comparison to, you know, an aardvark.
Right.
But they're still the same species and can technically, unfortunately, interbreed. But 10,000 years ago, though, I don't know if genetic isolation and stuff, if they'd be able to, they should be able to. But yeah, they would be the same thing. And it's one of those things, too. The indigenous here had small dingo-like American dogs, the Amerindian dog, and they were very small village dog-looking things. The Coster site has one in Illinois. It's 10,000 years old. But then the Spanish brought Mastiffs. The English brought, this little bulldog thing in Pocahontas, but I don't know what they... Greyhounds were like the most common dog in the Middle Ages, so, and ancient times. So something like that. And they would have looked similar. And it's also... I know I'm digressing way too hard on this one question.
No, but, you can digress as much as you want.
Cool. One of the sadder things of... you know, the New World, and I'm not a person who sits here and it's just like what everything the Spanish did wrong, you know, it's just like, it's what it is. But like, once their dog hops off the boat and runs into the woods with the native dogs, they're going to breed. And like, it wasn't that the Spanish were like, we're going to get rid of all these dogs. It's just like European dogs just came in a lot more population. Your Native American settlements died out with smallpox and disease. So their dogs then died out with no food to eat. It wasn't, in places it was intentional to eradicate native dogs, but it's just European dogs arriving in droves. And it's like the complete genetic replacement of Amerindian dogs is something not talked about, but it's like a huge factor of like, or a huge result of colonization. Yeah.
Are there any modern breeds that have any genetic inheritance from those indigenous breeds?
Chihuahuas and but what's interesting is it's like, it's so hard to describe this without drawing it, but like the Chihuahua we know today looks like the indigenous one, but it's completely European. So it's really? Like a European indigenous bred, and then like kind of like they did with the, what they're going to do with the mammoth when they breed an Asian elephant with the mammoth or whatever.
Right.
It's like,
it's
going to be, it's so hard to explain, but do you see what I'm saying?
Didn't they do that with the direwolf recently?
Kind of. The direwolf that they made is a wolf that has 6 genes altered to like have bigger ears and face.
Right.
And they're like, it's so a direwolf.
Like superficial, basically. Yeah.
Yeah,
completely.
Yeah, it's like it's their branded direwolf, but it's still cool. But yeah, it's like the Amerindian Chihuahuas. It's like they've just been diluted with European DNA too much. Yeah. But they've kept that prototype.
It's interesting because that just kind of speaks to how fast, I guess, humans and then by extension dogs exploded across the world, that, you know, even though there was tens of thousands of years that separated these humans from each other, that, you know, the humans were still able to obviously procreate with each other, and at the same time dogs were also at the same time able to procreate with each other because genetically they were still the same species. And so in our podcast we just did an episode on the paleo period of the Midwest, and just I think what's so interesting about that time period is just how quickly humans just spread everywhere, and it's just really interesting and cool. So
Yeah. Another food for thought too. Material, but a teacher had put this to me in this way. Like if aliens were to come like to our planet and like, you know, just like when Columbus met the Taino, like it's honestly scarier that, you know, Europeans arrived or other humans arrived, I should say, on the Caribbean than aliens, because they can get you sick and they can, you know, impregnate you. So it's like, it would never happen to us, like another species coming to the planet that can get us sick. Well, maybe they could get us sick, but impregnate us in that sense, you know? Yeah. But like, it's just a very like, it's just a wild thing to think about.
Yeah. It is a wild thing to think about. Absolutely. So if I can, I just want to ask one more question about, I guess, dog physiology and just adaptations. So along with barking, dogs began to display other kinds of physiological changes after many generations of contact with humans. What are some of the ways that physiology of dogs changed after human contact, and how much of these were affected by the environment and climate that they found themselves in? So just kind of to attach to that, we were talking about how much it was intentional versus kind of like environmental determinism. Maybe that's a bad way to put it. Environmental societal determinism. I'm just curious what other changes dogs went through throughout the course of human history.
Like biologically, you mean?
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, the puppy dog eyes, that's mm-hmm. been like, again, that's another thing I've seen scientifically said all the time. Mm-hmm. I don't know how you test for it, but like them raising their eyebrows, they're like having white sclera in their eyes is a very dog thing. Like chimps don't even have that mm-hmm. much white sclera. But like dogs, the best example I can give is the pug. Obviously, like you pointed out, it's the Victorian era. It's bred very intensely to look like that. Mm-hmm. But it has a very flat face, big eyes, small mouth. It's bred to look like a person, whether we want to accept that or not. And a lot of brachycephalic dogs like that. Yeah, right? You want it to look cuter and cuter and look like a person. Mm-hmm. And the more you do that, the cuter it gets, which is, you know, then you get domestication syndrome, and then you get the brachycephalic dogs like we have now that have like, you know, not to go in soapboxes about, you should breed these dogs, but I mean, it's just, they exist. So like,
yeah,
we'll talk about it. But like wiener dogs and stuff, they're all bred for like a task. Novelty, oh, yeah. Like,
yeah.
Originally, it was a task, and then like the longer dogs could go into burrows to get badgers out and stuff like that. But then that's become more of a like, well, how long can we make it? And like, that's when it becomes bad. Yeah, but they've changed. That is directly artificial selection in that sense. Mm-hmm. But in terms of natural selection, I think the standard yellow coat, like you'd see in a dingo. Mm-hmm. The flopped ears down, that's just domestication syndrome. And then their ability to speak, communicate, and like just emote with humans is definitely a side effect of domestication. Yeah.
A lot of things change when humans start to practice sedentism in agriculture societally, not just their relationship with dogs. You know, things can get more stratified. Socially, there's more specialization of labor and stuff. Mm-hmm. Is there a similar transformation in humans' relationship with dogs when humans stop kind of being so nomadic and seasonally based from location to location?
I don't know specifically in the Midwest, but as an example, I guess I was going to say, I'd assume so is where I'm going with that.
Yeah.
The Mississippians, sure. Like you can see just an insane amount of dog like population boom along with cultural boom and like population boom of humans, because mm-hmm. dogs are just they're just a parasite, really, if you boil it down, look at it objectively. They just the streets in Tenochtitlan too, when the Spanish got there, you can still see Mexico City today, there's like rampant amounts of homeless dogs everywhere, street dogs, India as well. And to my understanding, like I grew up in New York City, so it's like Long Island, but it's like there's no stray dogs running around, really. It's pretty well taken care of there. But most of the world, stray dogs is like a thing.
Yep.
I know in the Middle East, cats and dogs are all over the place. But
yep.
That, I think I'm derailing from the original question, but that's like
that's
how
okay.
dogs exist with people throughout mm-hmm. most of time. It wasn't always a beneficial, like there were pet dogs. The Romans had pet dogs. Greeks had pet dogs. But for the most part, dogs were just like that. It's just like a raccoon in our trash can right now. And I know Knoxville's plagued with raccoons. But yeah, it just like dogs exist where people do. And especially in the Mississippian period, just like in the Mesoamerica, the population of dogs just booms because there's food to eat and there's places they can sleep and hide that isn't the wilderness. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm very interested in, and it's, I would almost be impossible to tell when for sure humans started to develop like emotional relationships with their dogs. But I also wonder if that was more, not to say that people didn't have emotional relationships before they became sedentary, but I wonder if that's also an aspect of it where the practical use of a dog is still really important. It it helps out in the field with farming and stuff, and it might alert people to, you know, if someone was approaching the village or the settlement or whatever. But it's not the same function as a dog would, you know, a dog's role in a hunter-gatherer band or something like that. So I wonder if that was maybe where the emotional relationship started, possibly.
I mean, there's a burial 14,000 years ago in Germany. And it's like one of my colleagues was saying, it's a wolf, it's not a dog, but it's still buried. So it, you know, whatever. But it's buried with two people. So it's the first time that was intentionally done. Whether that means like love or affection, I don't know. Maybe it was just like a worthy adversary to put it to something.
Right.
But a solid example, I think, I want to say it's the Inuk. I think it's the Inuk. In the Arctic and Canada have like a sea goddess. She has a pet dog.
Oh, cool.
But they allow one, like all the dogs sleep outside, like the sled dogs, and they're only allowed to eat fish. They can't have caribou. They can't have whale because it will offend the other animals because they're traders. Seal. Yeah. Like basically you can just have like the lowest form of calories. But one dog was permitted to live inside the home and it was given a name and therefore that awarded it a soul. So it's like in that culture tradition, I guess on in their ontology, like awarding something a soul or a name gave it a soul in that sense. But the rest of them were seen as just purely utilitarian. And it's just like, even though it's the same biological creature that's inside the igloo or not, I don't think it's an igloo, but...
their dwelling.
It, whatever, just giving it a name gave it that much more cultural significance than the tools that were outside. Like
Really interesting. I'm glad that you brought up the Arctic because that was where I was going to ask you about next. So I'm just curious so obviously dog sleds are a really important form of transportation for the people, the indigenous people that live up there in the Arctic Circle and Northern Canada, parts of Alaska. What is the history of the dog sled technology and when does it first emerge? If you know, I'm really interested in this. I don't know much about it.
Yeah. Unfortunately, I'm not too well versed in that. I know it's very late from what we know. But again, if it's made out of wood and bone in the Arctic, like you're not going to see it.
Right.
I would like
survive very well. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah, I'd like to think Paleo Indians coming here, like we theoretically, genetically, they had dogs, but we don't have any evidence of it until 10,000 years ago.
Yeah,
but I'd like to think if you're big game hunting that hard, you have mammoth tusks to make, you know, as this is far fetched, but like as the sled, you know, and then put wood on it, fill that with meat. And you're basically just feeding mammoth meat to the dogs like you're feeding coal to a train. Like it just keeps going, you know? That's how you would colonize the Americas so fast.
Yeah.
But there's no evidence for it. And that's probably a pipe dream. But like, that's too cartoonish of an answer. But like,
yeah, that's kind of a that's kind of an awesome visual that you just described.
I just came up with that. I'm going to use that.
Oh, again. Great. That's great.
But yeah, sledding, I don't know. We know travois they had or travois in the plains they had for a long time. At least, you know, in ethnographic times, and then they used it with the horse. So I'd imagine they used that, especially in the old world. But to dog sledding in the way we know it, I know is like basically coincides with metallurgy, with, you know, it coming from either Russia or the Vikings or Americans.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Interesting. We recently did an episode on the paleo period, as I said, and something that was really interesting that you just kind of reminded me of is that, yeah, when it comes to that time period, the paleo period of the Americas, there isn't any like evidence of dogs, or at least not necessarily there's no evidence, but there's no direct material remains of, right, of dogs at paleo sites, which I find really interesting. The first example of like a dog remains are in the like succeeding period, the Archaic. And it's just really interesting because there's got to be some dog bones out there somewhere from that time period. I guess it's just a matter of time before we find it.
Yeah. And that would be why I go back for a PhD if I were to do it. I have too many interests, but
that's awesome.
Too many interests to spend 4 years on one. And I've dug paleo's like my bread and butter. And,
oh, really? Oh, awesome.
That's yeah. Cool. Thanks, man. But like to find a dog at, like, cause I worked at Laprelle, which is the big mammoth site here in Wyoming. Mm-hmm. You're not going to find dogs there because, like, if they're in the middle of camp, they probably would have been kicked out, you know, kicked, and they'd learn quickly not to come near the center of camp where they were tied up. So, in the main concentration of like the densely stratified artifact layer, you're not going to see dog bones. You might see some gnaw marks, but it could be coyote, it could be wolf. You'd have to dig around site to find like where dogs buried their bones somewhere. And that's a needle in a haystack more than finding a mammoth that was butchered, you know? So it's hard to tell until there's like a beautiful burial of, okay, this is a Clovis dog, like with Clovis points buried with it. We won't have that answer. Yeah.
Yeah. That's, it's so unfortunate because I mean, it's hard, but when it comes to human sites, they follow a certain kind of a logic. Especially if you know a little bit more about their culture. So like they might like to bury their remains in like mounds or certain, like in a certain direction or something. But like for a dog burying bones, it's just kind of a completely random needle in a haystack kind of a thing, as you were just saying. So with that being said, I wanted to ask you about the Eastern Woodlands and just kind of what you want, just see what you know about their dog human relationships, because that's kind of where my neck of the woods is, obviously, Midwest. And obviously it's like a huge and diverse area, but I'm curious what you know about dogs and if they served more of like a, if they still served for hunting or if they had some other purposes, and just kind of what you know about Eastern Woodland dog relationships, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, the Eastern Woodlands are just so huge and vast. Like the Cherokee technically count as Eastern Woodland, like even though they're Southeast. But yeah, I mean, specifically, I did a lot of like reading on the Iroquois because it just, there's so much French and British writing about them. And they had, I mean, the Iroquois are just so fascinating. But like once agriculture gets brought there about 1,000 years ago, like they get these giant palisades and like the longhouse thing and like the democracy kicks off and all that. And like the state level society kind of, with that agriculture boom, you see dog boom. And I know through several, you know, oral stories and things that I've read about them, there's like dogs that do help hunt. There's like hunting stories about dogs. I think there's a few burials. I know the Cherokee had a few. I can't recall any off the top of my head to say direct evidence of hunting dogs back then, but I know there's oral stories of it. And then they have like dog ceremonies where they would like eat a dog. That's also extremely common throughout the world. And then like there's like the dog clan, I believe, but that might be more modern. And yeah, it's just kind of the same thing. Like where state level society exists, dogs exist in huge population as well. Well, with that, then like comes a lot of mythological and ontological things. And it is the Iroquois that I think in the beginning of that paper I was saying, or that's the beginning of my lecture at least, like they were the ones that like took dogs in as like wards. Like it was like it was our job to care for them.
Right.
And Cherokee is an Iroquoian language, so it's very similar in that sense. Yeah. Like dogs are seen as like a different thing in the animal kingdom. Whereas bears are usually at the top. They like are the president of like talking with all the other animals. Dogs are also around there.
Yeah. That's cool. So you mentioned the Iroquois 1,000 years ago when, you know, agriculture started to really begin to be intensively used. And 1,000 years ago, honestly, in the Americas, in this neck of the woods is super interesting because you also have Cahokia at the same time start to grow as like a large settlement. And then also the Fort Ancient.
Sure.
There's just so many interesting things that are happening that state level societies are beginning to emerge. And just kind of like an alternate history kind of a way, it makes me really sad to think about what could have like progressed if had things, obviously Cahokia like famously dispersed before Europeans came, but still right. Fort Ancient was a thriving tradition and so were the Iroquois, what was a thriving kind of society and culture that just kind of went a completely different way because of contact and stuff like that. But
yeah, it's a significant bummer.
It is. Yeah, that's something that we could probably talk for hours and hours more about.
Yeah. I mean, even so too, it's like even before contact too, a lot of that stuff just due to climate just kind of, it's like just disappeared and all that too. Yeah.
So just to kind of pivot a little bit, I've got two more questions for you. I don't want to take up too much of your time.
Sure.
And they're just kind of wrap up questions. So you kind of mentioned that when you go to your PhD, you want to look for evidence of dogs in the paleo period. But mm-hmm. I'm just curious what, if you had any other research questions relating to human dog history, what would you like to see answered? And you yourself, what would you like to delve more into and look for as an archaeologist in the future?
I think dogs as a mythological, vessel or whatever you want to put, mythological item or subject is completely under researched. Like it's known obviously in like its own indigenous contexts, like around the world,
mm-hmm.
but I've yet to see somebody, like if a culture anthropologist wants a dissertation, like there's one just documenting every time dogs are mentioned in creation or the afterlife mm-hmm. or in some aspect of someone's culture like that. It's kind of like, I can't really think of an example of it, but it's just something that was so presumed that mm-hmm. like it just never was studied. So it's
right,
just like,
right. It's just, yeah.
Yeah. Kind of like I've noticed this too. There's not a lot of research on cats being domesticated because of eating rodents out of our granaries.
Yeah.
That's just presumed. But like whenever I go to like look that up, there's like not too much on it. So it's like,
so interesting you say that. I from what I've heard about cat domestication and I'm sure you know more than I do, so please correct me if I'm wrong, but
sure.
From what I understand, it came out of the Middle East, like Mesopotamia, mm-hmm. and basically it was a part of an episode where people were just domesticating everything around them, like so goats, cows, I know goats and cows for sure, and I think maybe sheep as well, and cats were just kind of a part of that local, they were just like a native species, and because there was humans did agriculture for so long, or at least horticulture, that they just kind of were a consequence of being around. They weren't like intentionally kind of.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know if that's what you've seen as well.
Same thing as a raccoon. Now, I know I've said that. I'm reading a book on this right now, actually. But
okay.
Raccoons in the same. It's just such a distinct, because we know them. They have little hands and they eat trash mm-hmm. and like aren't yeah. afraid of people. Same thing. Cats would have yeah. just like seen all the rodents because we're fermenting all that stuff. We're putting big storehouses of grain. They would have been like, what the hell? Just come and ate all the mice. So it makes sense. It's yeah. just, I've yet to, maybe I just haven't read as much on it, but I know there's not too much out there that I've seen.
That's cool.
And then another aspect of something that I would love to study is like understanding, like we know in Japan, the Ainu had, or the Hmong had dogs.
Mm-hmm.
Siberia, they had dogs. Germany, they had dogs. Right. North America, they had dogs in a lot of places. Finding cultures in the paleo period that had dogs, or at least, maybe archaic too in the Americas, mm-hmm. just not paleo. Finding them, knowing, okay, here's a sample of all cultures that we know had dogs. And then I want to analyze their toolkits and see like what their hunting weapons or their stone tools would look like and see if there's any like correlation between like, maybe they're using more of like javelins to like dispatch something versus like an actual projectile or you're probably not going to find too much info, but it'd be cool to do because I just want to combine the tools and the dogs. Yeah.
See how that like having a little or maybe not so little, but just like an animal that is basically will hunt the same thing that you do. It can like go in bursts of really fast speeds and has really powerful jaws. That's quite a hunting tool to have at your disposal if you're going to look at it from a kind of a utilitarian perspective. So that makes sense.
It is. And yeah, you don't have to invest too much time into your hunting technology if you have one that like does it for you, you know?
Right.
So yeah.
Cool. That's super cool. So lastly, I wanted to ask you, if someone wanted to dive deeper into this topic of human dog evolution or relationships, where would you suggest they start when it comes to your own content and then also just like books and documentaries that are out there in the ether? Where would you point people?
Yeah. I hate to toot me, but just the biggest accessible
do your
thing
horn. Yeah.
Would be The History of Dogs, Evolution, Archaeology, Mythology is my lecture on my YouTube. Find that on my website too. That's like your be all. Here's my, you know, 95 thesis on dogs.
Yeah.
But if you want to read like hard science, really cool stuff, anything by Dr. Angela Perry, she's like the leading expert in dogs right now, at least in genetics. But yeah, for her dissertation, she did like research in Japan with hunters. And she went to Nicaragua, I think, or she worked with someone that did stuff in Nicaragua. Anyway, she's done all the dog stuff. She's great. Mm. And then there's a book called Dogs by Darcy Morey. And that's like, I think the current dog archaeology book that's out there, but it's dated. And then, yeah, I'm writing one here soon.
Oh, cool.
That won't be out for 2 years probably, but.
Okay, awesome. So stay tuned.
I get it done. Yeah. But Angela Perry right now is she's the rock star in doing like the hard science out there. Yeah.
That's awesome. Well, thank you so much for sitting down and talking with me about dogs. It's been really fascinating. If you guys are interested in learning more about this topic, definitely check out David's social media platforms. So on Instagram, you are ethnocynology. Is that right? Okay. Yeah.
I was going to say, sino is Greek for dog. So sinology and then ethnocynology. And then that's the only one that's ethnocynology. The rest of them are all David Ian Howe.
Okay.
And I think if you type in David Ian Howe, my other ethnocynology comes up. Yeah.
Sweet. Thank you so much.
Yeah, man. Thanks for having me. This was fun.